Well, you can hear the bagpipers tuning into this song that we just played. It's called Mull of Kintyre. If you're looking for a song that sort of sets the tone for the foggy moors of Scotland, that's it. It is the biggest selling single of Paul McCartney's career. I mean, even eclipsing singles that he did with the Beatles, it sold something like 2 million copies in the UK and just seems to touch the pulse of the public there in ways that never caught on here in the US. Mull of Kintyre, great. Great song, and I think it works for the discussion about the lighthouse, the mystery of the Elan Moor, and the lighthouse keepers. Keith McCloskey's new book. When we come back, we're going to talk about how their disappearance was discovered, because that was a tragedy in its own way. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. All right, Keith McCloskey, let's get into the story of the disappearances themselves. I guess the first person to have an inkling that something might be wrong is a guy who was paid a small stipend to watch the watchers. In other words, he lived on some other island or a landmass, and it was his job to sort of keep an eye on the lighthouse. And if days went by and he didn't see anything, he was supposed to report it. So tell me about him.
Yeah, well, he had been appointed by the Northern Lighthouse Board to watch out from the main island, just to keep an eye. He was given a powerful telescope to watch for signals out there. The idea being if there was any problems, signals would be hoisted. But the trouble is, even though he was on the westernmost point of the main island with Lewis, it was still 20 miles away. And even though he had a fairly strong telescope, powerful telescope, it's not often that you would be able to see because of the atmospheric conditions and the place is known for bad weather, so if it's a dark, very heavy, stormy night, which seems to be the case most of December up there, you wouldn't be able to see anything anyway. But he used to keep a table of when he could see the lighthouse, but the last time he saw it was the 7th of December, which was the light kept operating up until the 15th of December, but in that time he didn't see it once because of the atmosphere, of the atmospheric conditions. But the fact that he hadn't seen the light after that, he expected he expected maybe not to see it for 6 or 7 days at a time when the weather was bad, but he would expect to be able to see it at some point. So the 15th of December came and went, and the time was marching on, and he couldn't see the light. The thing is, although he was looking for signals at night time, he'd look to see that the light was operating as well, but he just couldn't see it, and it was actually starting to concern him that he couldn't see it. But he hadn't done anything. It wasn't him that actually, if you like, was the person who was deeply disturbed by the lack of the light. That was the captain of a passing ship.
Yeah, this ship cruises into these waters. They don't see the light, and it had some bad results. Go ahead and tell that part of the story.
Yeah, well, what happened, there was a vessel called the Arch Tor, and it was coming from Philadelphia, and it had been really stormy weather out in the North Atlantic. And he started approaching the Flannan Isles, and they were keeping an eye out for the light, and they just couldn't see it. And they came within 5 to 6 miles of the actual islands. He wanted to see if he could see the islands themselves, just to, get his bearings. But apparently it was so dark that he couldn't make them out. But the light had a it would have been visible for 20 miles around. And here he was within, well within that range. He'd come 15 miles within range of the light, and he couldn't see it. And that was the night of the 15th and 16th of December. And it was that day that they disappeared. So he checked his bearings. He went further on then up to the north of Scotland to go around the top of Scotland and come down. He was going to Edinburgh, to the port for Edinburgh, which is Leith. And he thought it was really strange that he couldn't see the light at all. So he made a note that he would contact the Northern Lighthouse Board as soon as he arrived. But there was something happened which stopped him doing that, which was as they started approaching down the other side of Scotland, the ship hit a rock. and almost sank the ship. And he only managed to limp into the port of Leith and beach the vessel on the mud banks outside the port.
So when they get into port, they've got other things on their mind other than the fact that this lighthouse didn't have a light. I guess it came up in the course of explaining why they had a wreck, but
well,
that wasn't the first
happened.
Thing.
The thing is, he reached the port of Leith on the 17th of December, which is 2 days after they disappeared. But for a week they did nothing because, he was obviously worried about losing his command apart from anything else. You know, if you're the captain of a ship and you hit a rock, it doesn't say much for your navigation. So if you like, they had other problems on their mind. And it was only after the discovery of the men missing that the agents for the ship actually wrote a letter to the Northern Lighthouse Board and said, "We're very sorry, but we wanted to draw to your attention that the captain of the Archdor had noticed that the light wasn't on on the 15th of December, and they apologized for not informing them sooner, but that they had other things to be getting on with because of the problem with the ship nearly sinking."
We should, as an aside, should say if there's anything that's cursed in this story, it's this ship, right? Because it met with some bad luck later on.
Yep. Yeah, do you want me to mention
sure.
that now?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, the Archdor, as I say, was... you know, a bit of an unlucky vessel because it had only a couple of months before it had been, it was passing the Flannan Islands, its propeller shaft had broken out in the North Atlantic and it had to be towed into a port in Canada on the seaboard there. That cost them a lot of money. And then they came past the Flannans, and it's almost as if there was a curse associated with the Flannans, which I'll come on to later. You know, within 48 hours of passing it, the ship hits a rock and almost sinks. 12 years after that, they'd left Norfolk, Virginia, on their way to Rotterdam, and it sailed out of port, and that was the last anybody ever saw of it, and it just completely disappeared with everybody on board. And to this day, again, nobody knows what happened to it. But it's believed to have sunk in the North Atlantic. But again, nobody knows. It just disappeared.
So back to Elon Moore then. This ship lets somebody know eventually that there's something wrong with the lighthouse. How long does it take for somebody to get to the island to check it out?
Well, no. The point was that, you know, there was all these... if you like, worries, you know, the captain of the ship has seen the light, but he's basically, they've not told anybody, but it was a worrying factor. You've got Roderick Mackenzie, the watchman on the main island. He's getting disturbed about the lack of seeing the light, but he's done nothing either, if you like. So the relief goes out by ship. You know, the men get relieved on a regular basis every 28 days. But the ship that took them out, the Hesperus, was held up because of bad weather for a further couple of days. So from the 15th of December, you've got this delay going on and on. And it was Boxing Day, 26th of December, before the ship, actually the Hesperus, picked up the relief from the main island, from the shore station, to take the relief was Joseph Moore. And he was taking him out with supplies, you know, to replenish the supplies out there. That arrived on the about lunchtime on the 26th of December. They expected to see, when a ship was coming in to relieve with a relief keeper, they used to put a flag up, you know, to show basically the ship was expected. The keepers would be down at the landing stage because it was a very difficult island for anybody to get onto. You know, there was a concrete slipway, if you like, where the boats would come in, but the boat would have to be hauled in with ropes, and it was quite a tricky landing to make. And if the weather was too choppy, the lighthouse keeper would actually have to be hauled ashore on a rope, you know, on a kind of harness if the weather was too bad. So it was a tricky operation, and they expected at least two of the keepers to be there. And that was another thing I want to mention at this stage, is that the lighthouse regulations stipulated that one man out of the three always, whoever that man was, always had to be in the lighthouse. If the other two were out, he wasn't allowed to go out. So you had somebody in the station all the time. So they expected to see at least two keepers there to help the relief get ashore. So the Hesperus came around, and they noticed first that the flag wasn't up on the flagpole to show that the vessel was expected. And they didn't see anybody down at the landing stage, which seemed very odd. So they thought, well, you know, maybe, and it would have been probably a disciplinary offence for the flag not to have gone up and for everything to be ready for the ship to start unloading. But they fired a rocket, a signal rocket, and gave a couple of blasts on the horn to try and alert them in the lighthouse to say, well, you know, we're out here, we're waiting for you. And nothing happened. So they, after about 30, 35 minutes, they decided to lower a boat with Joseph Moore in it and take him ashore to go up to the lighthouse and see what was going on. And initially, at this stage, their thoughts were that the men were all incapacitated through illness. And the idea was to get Moore up there as fast as possible to see what was going on. And I should say, I mean, having done it myself, it's where you land on the landing stage, you've got a walk up steep steps. You're basically going up the side of a cliff, so it's some distance to go. And then the walk up to the actual lighthouse is, itself is on quite steep ground, so it's a bit of an effort to do it. Anyway, the boat dropped Moore off. They managed to get him on without any ropes. He was able to jump onto the stage, and then he made his way up there. So he approached the lighthouse. Again, he couldn't see anybody. The gate was closed. There was a kind of a fenced area in front of the lighthouse. He opened the gate, went up to the door, which was closed but not locked, leading into the lighthouse, and he went in. And he checked all the rooms, checked the bedrooms. He saw that the clock had stopped in the kitchen. The beds were all made. The place was neat and tidy. They'd obviously, he believed, they'd had lunch because everything had been washed and put away. There was nobody up in the lighthouse itself, in the actual light tower. The blinds were drawn, and he was felt quite uneasy about it as he was walking through. In his statement later, he said, as soon as I started walking through the lighthouse, it was only too soon I realized that something dreadful had happened. And he ran back down to the landing stage, went out to the ship and told the captain, and said that the men had all disappeared with no sign of them at all. And the captain then sent Moore back with two more men to actually start searching the island. And the island can be searched in no time at all. It's not very big. Obviously, there's rocks there, but it was unlikely that all three of them would have gone out and fallen down onto the rocks, but they couldn't see anything. So that was basically how it was discovered. And as Moore, as I mentioned earlier, was walking up to the lighthouse itself, he said he saw, he didn't put this in his official report, he said there were three large black birds on the actual light tower. And as he approached up to the lighthouse station, the three of the birds flew off up in towards the sky. And disappeared, which he took as he was a very superstitious man, Joseph Moore. He took it as quite a bad omen.
They were able to reconstruct quite a bit of what had gone on prior to whatever calamity befell these guys. Looking at different equipment and things that were sitting around, they were able to reconstruct it, and there was a logbook, I guess, as well. So tell us the story. I was impressed by how thoroughly they sort of put things together in a chronological order of how much they figured out, even though they never got to the ultimate answer.
Well, it's Moore was the first in, as I say, and he looked at the, I mean, I suppose it's natural to go to the logbook, you know, although the clock had stopped, everything was in its place. I should mention also that he noticed that the outdoor gear of two of the men, the principal, James Duckett, and Thomas Marshall, the assistant lightkeeper, their outdoor weather gear was gone with the sea boots. they'd gone from their pegs. But on the third peg, the outdoor gear for the occasional Donald MacArthur, that was still on its peg, which meant he was still in his shirt sleeves. He noticed that, but he went to the logbook and to try and, if you like, see what had been, you know, how far they'd kept the book up to. And what used to happen was you would update the logbook, and the following day you would write everything on a slate with a piece of chalk. So then that would be transferred into the logbook by the principal the following day. And he noticed that they'd taken the logbook had been kept up to the previous day, and that the weather had been recorded. There was squally with showers at 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock that morning of the 15th of December. So he was able to deduce that they'd been there that morning when they would have been doing their duties and cleaning and what have you, and that they'd had their lunch. And then it was at some point after that that they had disappeared. So they'd obviously had their lunch. The cook, who was ever the person who was duty cook, had washed and cleaned up and put everything away. And he said there was nothing out of place at all. There is talk of an overturned chair and an uneaten meal, but that comes from a poem that was written in 1912. But a lot of people refer to that as if that actually happened. But in the report, the official report that was done by the superintendent, he says everything. And in a way, it makes it even more eerie, the fact that everything is in its place. It's not as if anybody's rushed out or, you know, anything's been damaged or there'd been a fight or anything like that. Everything was spick and span.
You make the point in the book that over the years, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say it's almost as if they tidied the place up and walked out the door.
And jumped off a cliff.
Yeah. But they just disappeared. That was it had a deeply unsettling effect on Joseph Moore. He became highly agitated at what he'd found. You know, probably because he was the first person to see it all as it was.
You make the point in the book that this sort of had been sensationalized. Different versions that are written over the years that they will borrow from the legend of the Mary Celeste, for example, the turned over chair and the half eaten meal and
the half eaten meal. And yeah, I mean, the thing is with the Mary Celeste, you know, it's, you say the half eaten meal and the lukewarm cup of tea, but in some ways for me, this is stranger because there's nothing, you know, it's like they were there and then they weren't. It's not like something, you know, if there's a half eaten meal, it implies something had happened, that they had to leave it, but there was nothing like that. You know, the beds were made, so the man who was on duty that night hadn't gone to bed to prepare himself for, you know, so he would have gone to bed probably about 2 o'clock or thereabouts. But whatever happened, it happened immediately some point after lunch. But, it, you know, they were just gone, and there was no, other than the outdoor gear of two of them, but the outdoor gear for the third man, for MacArthur, was still on its peg, and his boots were still there.
So, as you write, there were inquiries. You know, there was a lot of speculation. There were some general sort of conclusions, not really conclusions, but ideas were put down. But there was never a police investigation. That struck me as one of the strangest things. I mean, three men obviously are dead. They never came back, and there was never a police investigation. We're going to get into that after we come back. And then we'll go down sort of a laundry list of some of the theories that you describe. Some of them pretty creative, Keith. Psychedelic sort of substances that might have drawn made him go a little bit crazy.
Yeah.
And then the possibility of good old-fashioned murder raises its head, given the temperament of at least one of these guys that you mentioned in the book. We'll be back with Keith McCloskey talking about the mystery of this lighthouse, the mystery of the Elon Moore, and these three lighthouse keepers that vanished off the face of the earth. Big Country takes us into the break on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Keith McCloskey about his excellent new book called The Lighthouse, The Mystery of the Elon Moore Lighthouse Keepers, three men who just completely vanished, dropped off the face of the earth, were never seen again, and inquiries were made and a lot of theories developed, but the mystery has never been solved. Was it murder? Was it just a series of terrible errors? Could it have been a giant wave that washed over the island? or something supernatural. We're going to get into some of the possibilities right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Keith McCloskey, we get to the heart of this mystery now. Of course, there were inquiries made. Three guys disappear. They're not there to take care of the lighthouse. Obviously, something went wrong, so the company they work for is looking into it. But you note in the book that the police never did an investigation. How's that? How's that possible?
Well, how it's possible, God knows. It certainly wouldn't happen today. If you imagine, you can't even say it was a work accident because nobody knows for sure whether it was an accident. The three of them could have been murdered by anybody, if you like. But the police did not investigate. It was actually left to the superintendent, who was in charge of all the lighthouses, to carry out the investigation himself. And one of the odd things about it, I meant to mention earlier, was we talked about the logbook, but the logbook has disappeared. If you make inquiries about it now, either to the Northern Lighthouse Board or to the Scottish National Archive, where all the records are, there's no trace of the actual logbook itself. And you would think that that would be the most important document to keep hold of, you know, all the letters, the letter from the captain of the Arch Tor and the superintendent's report. Every other document is actually in the archive, but not the logbook. So that's disappeared as well.
Well, let me ask you this. Would that be a collectible for somebody who's into lighthouse lore? Would that be a really valuable thing?
Yeah, it would be, most definitely. But having said that, nobody seems to know. You'd think there'd be a tracker kept of where it went or what happened to it. My feeling is that when the superintendent went up to carry out the investigation, he took it back to Edinburgh with him, to the head office. One theory why the police weren't involved is that the Northern Lighthouse Board had some senior legal figures who helped to run it, and that the incident, if you like, reflected quite badly on the Lighthouse Board, so that the less fuss that was made about the whole thing, the better. Yeah, but it's just a theory, you know.
Well, there's a lot of that going around. That's still the way things are.
It's strange that you think, you know, you would think that the police would at least have had some involvement in it, rather than leave it basically to one man to investigate what happened.
So what is the prosaic accepted explanation that these guys screwed up? One of them fell in the water, somebody went to rescue him, then the third one abandoned his post and did the same?
Well, it's the giant wave theory, you know, and many people say it's a lighthouse. It's obviously a wave, but when you talk to lighthouse keepers and when you look at the weather conditions and various other aspects of it, it's not actually that obvious at all. The point about it is that a wave cannot have taken all three of them at the same time because one of them was still in the lighthouse. A theory was put forward by one of the lighthouse keepers in the 1950s who was based out there. He says he thinks that one man fell into the water, the other man ran back to the station to get the third man. He didn't bother putting on his coat, he just ran down with him, and then those two were swept away as well. But if you're at the reason why they would have been there was a box of ropes, and this is what Robert Muirhead, who was the superintendent, he carried out the investigation. He felt that they had been checking that a box of ropes was okay. It was 110 feet above sea level, and it was wedged into a rock, and that the wave had swept them away. Swept at least one of them away, if you like, from there. But the thing is, you're asked to believe, if you like, that a freak wave, 110 feet came along, at least 110 feet came along, swept one of them away. Two of them came along, and then they were both swept away by another freak wave. It's not that likely. And the main thing, the argument against that is when I've talked to lighthouse keepers, including a man who was actually stationed out there in the 1960s, and any lighthouse keeper will tell you that the two things. One is that you do all the jobs in the morning and the afternoon is, you know, take it easy sort of thing in preparation for the duties later in the evening and at night. So it's unlikely they would have gone down there. The light would have been fading as well because it was December. This was just after lunch. So why would you leave a job like that till after lunch when it was just about to get dark fairly early? And the other thing any lighthouse keeper will tell you is that in bad weather, you stay indoors because you're putting yourself at risk. And what the weather that day was actually building up to just below storm force. So the waves were certainly there. But James Duckett, a man with 22 years experience behind him, would not needlessly have put his life at risk or that of the people who worked for him. So the giant wave theory doesn't, you know, it isn't quite as obvious as you might think.
Do all of the current lighthouse guys that you talked to and interviewed, is this story familiar to all of them? Is it sort of like,
everybody knows the story inside out. As we said earlier, it was a major story at the time, but everybody who works for the Northern Lighthouse Board knows the story of the Flannans, and it's a fairly well-known story in Scotland as well, purely because it's such a mystery, you know, it was never solved. But the Flannans was not a popular posting amongst the lighthousemen.
I could imagine being the replacement guys. You'd have a tough time getting people to station out there after that.
Well, the nickname for it was the Kennel, because it was such a small, pokey place, plus everything that was associated with it. You know, to be stuck on a rock lighthouse was not the most popular of postings either, because you weren't on either a large island or the mainland. You were basically stuck out there, so it wouldn't have been popular for that reason. But also it has the history associated with it. There was also another lighthouse keeper who went mad out there in the 1930s, and he had to be tied to his bed. It was the principal as well. So basically the boss had gone mad and had to be tied to his bed, and they had to get somebody out to remove him.
You had written, I forget where it is in the book, but you had written something about how these lighthouse guys sort of develop a sixth sense or a hidden sense, and that they've ones that have worked out there just get the creeps being around that lighthouse.
They do, yeah. I've been on that island myself, and it's a very strange atmosphere to it. Even humans, you know, they say animals have a kind of sixth sense, but it's a peculiar feeling. And while we were out there, we were filming, it was a brilliant day. It was April, brilliant sunshine, and suddenly a wall of fog came in from nowhere. Literally within minutes, the whole island was enveloped in fog. It was such a spooky sort of place, and the only way you could keep to where you were, to find your bearings, there's a kind of a little rail track that comes down from the lighthouse that goes down to both landings. So you had to keep to that to be able to find your way along. And within an hour, the fog had moved on. But it was, I don't know if you've ever seen the John Carpenter film, The Fog. That's what it was like.
Yeah.
I'm not saying there was weird things in it, but it was quite spooky because I was about 300 or 400 feet away from the lighthouse, and you could see it gradually disappearing in this fog. And suddenly the whole island was enveloped in it, and we had to stick to the rail line to be, you know, make sure we didn't wander off over near the cliffs.
I thought one of the most entertaining parts of your book, The Lighthouse, was tying in other legends and lore and mysteries. For example, in discussing the big wave theory, you mentioned the Edmund Fitzgerald. How does that fit?
Well, it's this idea of a giant wave. You know, the Edmund Fitzgerald was I believe at the time it was one of the largest ships on the Great Lakes. You know, and that just virtually disappeared without trace. You know, it's to show that the damage that giant waves can do, there was another ship not far from the Edmund Fitzgerald, which had said that there was a series of waves coming, you know, which was hitting the ship and eventually overwhelming it. So it's to try and get this idea of the potential destructive power of giant waves. But, you know, the trouble is things just disappear, you know. But I don't know that the waves, a giant wave applies in the case of these men. But one thing that came out in the report when we're talking about the destruction of a ship like the Edmund Fitzgerald is the power of a large wave. And because in the report that was done by Robert Muirhead on what happened, when Joseph Moore and later Muirhead arrived a couple of days later on the island, they came onto the East Landing, which is the other side, if you like, to the it's not hit by waves so hard. The weather tends to be mainly westerly winds. When they went over to the other side, to the West Landing, it was like everything had been pulverized on it. You know, the railings had been torn out of the concrete. There was a life buoy had been torn away with just bits of rag hanging on it, and the whole it's like something, a nuclear blast had hit that side of the island. But it must have been a tremendous wave that hit it, and they naturally put two and two together and said, well, this is what happened, the men disappeared. But the Highland and Islands University up in Lewis on the main island, they did a mathematical model of the weather for that whole month, and that wave that hit and caused all that damage to the island actually happened 2 days after they disappeared. It was nearly a hurricane that hit the island that day on the 17th, but they disappeared on the 15th. But the trouble is, again, it's all conjecture, you know, with Muirhead being the only man there, and presumably he didn't bother or didn't want to highlight too much that the damage may have been caused after the men disappeared, but it fitted his scenario very well, you know, by saying, look, here's a massive wave hit it. Obviously, the men were swept away, but without pointing out that it happened afterwards. He does say that there had been storms later in the month, but that storm or near hurricane on the 17th was a really powerful one. When we did the mathematical models, it showed that the red was the center of the storm, if you like, and it passed over the Flannan Isles.
You also tie in sort of the story of the Pied Piper, the legend of the Pied Piper, in discussing another scenario in that maybe their food was poisoned or contaminated by stuff that sort of made
ergot. It's a theory that when you think what could have happened to the men, if you discount the wave, you know, you start looking at other things, and murder is one, but certainly the men, you know, being affected by something mentally. There's mercury poisoning as well, because the lights used to float in a bath of mercury. I'll come on to that in a moment, but just talking about the point, you get ergot in bread. The men had flour and bread out there, and, you know, it can become contaminated with ergot, and you eat it, and it causes all sorts of hallucinations. And it's quite possible that they ate contaminated bread, and, you know, they lost their minds. And of course, when, you know, you're hallucinating, you're not aware of the danger to yourself, because where the lighthouse is, if you walk out of the far side of it, you're literally 12 feet, and you're by a cliff that drops 300 feet straight into the water. So, you know, it's a possibility that they ate contaminated bread. But there's also mercury poisoning, which can affect you. You know, the saying, as mad as a hatter.
Sure.
You know, mercury was used in millinery and making hats, and that's where the expression came from. But all three men would have been working with the mercury up in the light tower, and that could have affected them as well.
Well, it would require them all three at the same time, though, to go jump
off
the cliff.
No, not necessarily, yeah. Because it builds up over a period of time.
But they all disappeared at the same time, though.
Well, they did, yes. Yeah, that's true, yeah. But, I mean, you know, equally, it could be that one of them, not everybody gets affected by mercury, but maybe one of them did get affected by it and did away with the other two and himself. It's just a theory.
Well, let's talk about the murder theory. You have you mentioned the temperament in the book, the temperament of the third employee there, that he was known as sort of a hot-tempered guy. So I guess you have to keep that possibility open, that one of them murdered the other two, or?
Well, he was the lowest in the pecking order. He was known to have quite a fierce temper. He wasn't necessarily a big man. He'd been in the army. It was rumored that he was a drinker, but he was also supposedly quite a religious man. But then even I've known people who are quite religious who are quite heavy drinkers as well. But he was known for his temper. He had quite a violent temper. And being the lowest in the pecking order probably, wouldn't have helped either, because it's quite possibly he was a man who didn't care much for being given orders. And the thing is, in a lighthouse, it's very much not a sort of situation where would you like to do this job, whether you feel like it or not. It's you do that and do it my way. The hierarchy is so strict that, it's you do as you're told and there's no argument. And he probably, I wouldn't imagine if he had a bit of a temper, would have taken too kindly to that. But the other thing about it is he'd been stuck out there. He was taken out there in the middle of September. So he'd done a couple of weeks in September. He spent nearly all of October there, nearly all of November, and he'd been out there for the first 2 weeks of December up to the day they disappeared. So he'd worked all that time hardly without a break. And to be on an island like that, you need to get a break every 28 days, which is what the others were getting. But with William Ross off ill, who he was covering for, there seemed to be no idea when Ross was going to come back. So he had a croft to run, like a kind of allotment, and he had his family there. So it's quite possible that his nerves were starting to get frayed. We've probably all done it. You've been asked to do something and it's been far more than you expected. And after 2-3 months of being stuck out there, when most people get relieved after a month, I would imagine that his temper was probably building up like a pressure cooker. And it could be that he was asked to do something by the principal, James Duckett, and his temper just exploded.
Are there any, you have an entire chapter on the supernatural possibilities that have been raised by different writers over the years. I imagine some pretty wild tales have been told. Are there any of those that, at least for you, I'm not saying you conclude or agree with them, but that it are still open for you?
I mean, this talk of, the dead being taken out there, and it's interesting that you mentioned that, because I'll come on to Joseph Moore. He didn't believe in the sky folk, but he did believe quite strongly in the sanctity of the graves being disturbed out there by the building of the lighthouse. He became so agitated after he found the men missing, because he knew them all, he'd been working with them. But he became so agitated of what had happened that he didn't want to stay on the island, but of course he was the only one left, if you like, who knew how to run that particular station. And in his report, Robert Muirhead said, Moore is showing great signs of agitation. If this continues, I'm going to have to take him off the island, which is in effect what happened. Once they'd managed to get some replacements for the men who disappeared, Moore went off the island and he never went back. But Moore had said that the night the three of them disappeared, the 15th, he was in a cottage at the shore station, and he thought that the boathouse was on fire. He looked out of the window in the middle of the night, and he thought he saw the boathouse on fire near the cottage, and he ran down and found there wasn't a fire. But that was the night that the three men disappeared. And
that's quite a coincidence. Keith McCloskey's new book, The Lighthouse, is a fascinating read. When we come back, we'll be opening up the phone lines with your questions about this, and we'll get an update from him about Dyatlov Pass, another strange mystery. The Doors take us into the break on Coast to Coast AM.